Javon Fallon Hogan is no stranger to Hollywood. She's been an SNL cast member, had a guest appearance on Seinfeld, and appeared in movies including Men in Black and Forrest Gump. As a Catholic, she's had to navigate some tough situations in the entertainment industry. But it's also given her opportunities to share her faith with others and learn to trust in God's plan for her career.
How has the advice changed of what you would say to somebody when you were getting started versus today? Like a person who's got some type of faith understanding.
I would say, look, it's going to be tough, but stick with your faith because you don't want to be my age and look back and regret. You have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and you have to realize that there's a plan.
This is Living the Call.
Javon Fallon Hogan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Charlie. I really appreciate
it. It's a privilege to have you. Oh my goodness, I know we've been talking about doing this for a while, and I know I don't have unlimited time with you. But I appreciate you you making the time to come here. Unfortunately, we're not live together, but we'll make do with technology.
Exactly.
Have you used one of these online podcast studios
before?
I have.
It's so crazy. It's like George Jetson. You can't believe it. As a matter of fact, the other day I just did something and I live in New Jersey and this guy writes to me, hey, I saw a palm tree in the back. If you're in California, I'd like to be on my show. I go, that's no palm tree. I don't know what you're seeing.
Was that one of those like backgrounds that you can add to the...
No, it was. I was sitting in my backyard. He must have been seeing things.
Yeah. No, it's crazy how like that. Now there's like special, software for just podcasting and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I'm lucky I can even get on.
Well, we're on. So let's get to it. Siobhan, for those people who might not know you, I want to qualify that. People who might not know your name, because I concede that probably everybody knows you from just all of the work that you've been involved with as a character actress and as an actress just in general in Hollywood and the people that you've worked with. You've been in like major seminal movies, Forrest Gump, Men in Black. You've been on SNL. You've worked with, Robert Zemeckis and Lars von Trier and Barry Sonnenfeld and just all of these different people. And, but yet sometimes when I mention your name, people go like, who? And then they see your face. They're like, oh yeah, I definitely know her. I'm sure you get that.
Oh, I do. I'll get like, some people know me from certain things and I'll kind of know like what their background is like. Like if someone says, oh, I know you from Lars von Trier. I'm like, they're highbrow and they know foreign films. I better step it up a notch. But then it can go the other way where people be like, I know you. Did I go to school with you? Or like, what did you do Friday night? Yeah. So it's, different varieties of what happens.
And different contexts too.
Yes.
In your Wikipedia entry, by the way, it's really interesting because the very end it says something, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says like, Siobhan is a devout Catholic and it has shaped her, casting decisions or something along the lines of that. I don't never know how the Wikipedia things get done. I know they can be edited in a variety of different ways, but it's in there.
Yeah, I think because of different articles throughout the years and whoever wrote it must have just sort of, did a little tiny little synopsis.
Yeah. And I think, go ahead.
So I was going to say, it's not only shaped my career, it's shaped my wallet.
I bet. How so?
It's not as thick as it could be, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I mean, and that is about some of the bearing the cross, right? In a variety of different ways. I've had a conversation not too long ago. I had a conversation with somebody recently, somebody actually that you know, and we were talking about the reality of being a person of faith in the entertainment industry,
right?
And I mean, I'd love to hear your experience just broadly about that. And my thought in general was that there's at least kind of two different ways that you can experience difficulties being a devout Christian in the entertainment industry. One side could be sort of an explicit, somebody saying, oh, I don't want to work with Christians or whatever. And maybe some of that happens, but it seems like it might be pretty minimal. But then the other side might be just things that, in some meeting, somebody just says, oh, but that person's like really religious. So maybe we don't think about them. Like, so it's almost like a by omission and by commission that the challenges might exist. Is that fair characterization?
Yes. I think that, first of all, it started off for me, was it really, well, of course your religious background forms your ethical and moral choices, right? So it's all kind of this, you're just kind of this mix. So at first it was always like, you know, really gross, like I would always kind of like say no to material that I felt was gross or that was, you know, didn't stick with me. And I thought it was egregious, that kind of thing. And I had no business, you know, kind of saying no to things or, but my family and my father and I were really close, and my mom and I were really close. And a lot of it was out of respect for my parents. I was like, hey, you know, cause you can be tempted like crazy, like by the money or by the fame when you're early young. I always feel sorry for the young people, especially now, cause the material's even so much, you know, worse now and constantly, you know, there's the bulk of it, you know, you get to page two and you're like, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. So like early on, like with SNL and stuff, I was just like very clear. I was like, no, I'm not doing that. And I wasn't ever like rude about it, or I was just like, oh no, my father will kill me. Then religiously, it was later on that I was, you know, asked to do parts that were offensive to my religion and to God and, you know, in that way. And then I was like, oh, hey, no, I'm not, you know, I was like on a TV show and it was like sort of, the character had been established, you know, and all of a sudden there was a U-turn and my character was supposed to start having an affair at mass. And I was like, oh, this isn't happening.
Whoa.
You know, and it's really funny how, you know, and you know, it's, there's kind of like a hierarchy. It's like, you know, like a pyramid, like there's the producer, there's the executive producer, there's the writers, and then there's you, there's the actors. So, and then below, you know, and it's so stupid. Like the European system, it's not like that. It's like, you know, all for one and one for all, like a play. And so then below would what they even call it below the line.
Yeah.
So like the makeup artist, the prop guy, that kind of thing. So I remember I was, you know, it was great. I was like, I'm on a series. This is awesome. And suddenly I got the script. And I think that God has such good sense of humor. It was like, my character would start having an affair that would start at mass. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, what are the chances? So it actually would strike me really funny. I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to need to talk to the producer. So that'd be my trailer. Like, that's like, you know, like a kid in like seventh grade calling the principal in and saying, hey, by the way, you know, I'm not eating that lunch that you serve anymore. And you need to talk to your people. So I was like, look, I have to quit. I mean, I mean, either you can change the character. Well, that's not the way we have the character going. I was like, yeah, that's not what I signed up for, which is why I really always loved movies. Cause you know, you know what you're getting.
Sure.
Start to finish.
Right. The characters don't develop necessarily over like a giant multi-year series or something where a character can be really well fleshed out and rounded. And then all of a sudden they become either sort of side character or vice versa, right? They start with some kind of, you know, aesthetic or some value. And then all of a sudden that gets jettisoned like in season
exactly.
two. Yeah.
So I just said, look, I have kids. My daughter, Bernadette, at the time, she was like a young teenager. And I said, look, I have kids. I have to set a standard and I can't be a hypocrite. And they're like, well, don't you tell your kids. It's so funny. Like people will try it. It's like dating. It's like, don't you tell your kids that like, that you're an actress, you know, like it's, you know, trying to talk you out of it. It's like, hey, listen, there's no bargaining here. But then I remember I had to do the a final episode that was already in, you know, nothing to do with that, but it was happening. And I remember the makeup artists were like, we're so glad, putting up my makeup on. They're like, so glad you stuck up for us. This is great. And you've come to find out that a lot of people, you know, are just waiting for someone to be the mouthpiece.
I can totally imagine that. I can totally imagine that. Like people were like watching this thing happen and they're going like, I agree with her. Like this is either exploitative or it's whatever it might be, but it takes just that one person going, nah, it doesn't work. And then all of a sudden you get some backup.
Exactly. Which is great. You know what I mean? And then actually, like I said, with like the sense of humor, like God's sense of humor, like then you're sitting on set and you're like, this is really weird. This is like when I was in eighth grade and I had nobody to sit with at lunch. And it struck me really funny. Mm. Like, I can't believe that I'm in this situation and people are actually mad at me about it.
Yeah.
So,
and can you recall like a particular, maybe the first time in your career where you kind of faced that challenge and that moment of having to sort of say something?
Well, when I was on SNL, I think it was like literally 3 weeks into, and there was a scene that I was like supposed to be like a real sleaze and something that I wouldn't do to this day. I wouldn't tell anybody to do it. And it was like simulating something that I was no way was I going to be part of. And it's a very nocturnal show. And I got a call late at night and these guys were like, Sean, you got the part and you're going to be on the table. And I'm like, oh yeah, see, no, I'm not doing that. Why not? Well, first of all, my father will kill me. yeah, but you know, it's so funny. And what are you going to tell the boss? And I was like, oh, I don't care. You know, what if I'm dead? It doesn't matter. So, but then I remember, then they called right back. Hey, listen, you know, and all, you know, it's always kind of the way. It's kind of like, you sure? Because so-and-so is going to be mad. What if it is? And you come to find out, which I try to encourage, you know, a lot of people will have their kids call me or they'll say, you know, my kid's really nervous about getting into it. The truth is, if you're really honest and you're like, look, I'm not condemning you, but I'm not doing that. Then, and you know, you do it sort of in a way that's, you know, you maybe with humor, maybe not with humor, but people don't take offense because they kind of like know it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, oh, by the way, like things will happen like, oh, this commercial also pulled out hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you're like, oh, isn't that funny? You know what I mean?
Right. But doesn't that presuppose in those cases, like you're already in the room, you've already got the role, you're like already on set. Like, yeah. What about cases where like you might never get there because you have to have that conversation before the person says, yeah,
well,
you got.
I would just, even to this day, I'll look at the script and I'll either say if I want to get into it, I'll say something, or now I'll just say, I'm going to pass. Believe me, they'll be like, oh, and you know, and then you'll find out you're not the only one passing. I mean, there's a few others, you know what I mean? I've also been in situations where I said, you know, because now I'll get offered roles, you know, don't have to audition all the time. Sometimes I do, and I'll say, okay, here's the deal. I like your script. I think you're a good, great writer, but why are you doing that there? I don't like that. I'm uncomfortable with it. If you can change that, I'm all in. And that has worked, you know, like I actually just had a friend, today who actually went to Catholic U with and sent me a script. And he said, would you be in this reading of this play? And I said, well, I got to tell you, there's this one section I'm really uncomfortable with. I don't think joking about that particular topic is funny. And I think you could have the same effect. Like if you want this character to be abrasive and kind of an odd sense of humor, you could do the same thing without using that topic, you know, like, and to be honest with you, the topic is abortion. I was like, there's nothing funny about that. That's not funny in any way. And I said, and also I said, why would you want to take half your audience or whatever percentages? Why would you want to pull them out?
Right.
And go, you know what? I don't like this. It's like you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot I don't know if it's a political reason or what it is, but I just would never go there. You know what I mean?
It reminds me of the famous quote from Michael Jordan at some point about political issues. And he was like, hey, we got lots of people buy Jordans. He's like, I'm not trying to upset half the potential marketplace for my shoes. So that's why I'm not going to get involved in topic X or topic Y or that kind of thing. Sort of an economic.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Oscars. It's like, you know, nobody, like actors really were our job is to entertain and to take people out of their daily lives and give them, or maybe even if you're even really lucky, be in a film that sends a message. But our job is not to be telling people, talking about politics or extremely controversial subjects that are offensive. You know what I mean? Like it's not, so it's kind of insanely egotistical to think that someone cares in that kind of like an award show, what you think.
Yeah. But it is amazing. Like, and look, I haven't clearly not been involved in the scenarios that you have, but I've spent some amount of time in the entertainment industry and in various roles. And there is almost like this, kind of mass hypnosis at some point, like you touched on earlier, where you're like, everybody's on set. Maybe 25% of people are thinking the same thing you're thinking, but you're the first person to say it. I was, I don't know. Have you seen this documentary? It's called Quiet on Set, the whole Nickelodeon.
Yes. So yeah. And the crazy thing about that is I worked with Jeanette McCurdy years ago and I was on, oh, I don't even know, couple of Disney shows. And first of all, I always told people, they would say, my kid is really good. She's good at this. She's good at that. I said, do not put your kid in this business. People in it on a small level it would almost be like more of a misdemeanor, you know, I guess in a court of law compared to what happened on that, which is they don't even know how to curtail their language.
Yeah.
Like it's an adult business. So to keep your kid out of it, they say, what should I do then? She's so talented. I said, do community theater, do the school plays. But there's no reason. And don't take away their childhood. You know, let them have an upbringing where they have friends over and let them put a play on in the backyard or be at the school play. But yeah, I mean, and that that documentary, the crew was like, yeah, it was weird. It was weird. So for them to stand up and say something, they would probably have been fired at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was always, listen, I'm Irish. I love a good fight too. I mean, I was always, you know, like with my kids at school, you know, people would say, well, don't say anything because then they won't be on such and such team. And don't say anything because, you know, I mean, there was a time once that there was I have three kids, you know, two daughters and a son. And I was a terrible student. But my mother was like, well, you were street smart though. And that was exactly my son. Mm. Really funny, president of his class. But, and I'm a terrible cook. And this isn't even cooking. This is just literally mixing. I was making guacamole one night and I thought the avocados looked a little off. But you know, like when boys get to that age where they're like, I think it was in 10th grade. They're just devouring everything. You're like, oh, listen, I'll just put a little mayonnaise in. It's not going to be a problem. So anyway, he ends up throwing up violently. We had to go to the hospital. So I grabbed the book that he was reading. And he's 25 now. So this is, you know, this is 10 years ago. And I'm like, this thing is filthy. Mm. This is pornography. Mm. So I sent out to.
Was it a school book or was this something he picked up?
Public school. He went to Catholic school till 8th grade. Now he's in public school. And I'm like, and it was an Irish writer. And I know most of the great Irish writers, I hope, are playwrights and novelists. You know, I did a semester in Ireland. I pride myself on being Irish. I was like, who is this? And I remember asking Jim Sheridan, who did, you know, The Name of the Father. I said,
of course.
You ever heard of so-and-so? Oh, no, it's a joke. But anyway, so not only is it's filthy, but why is the school teaching a sub-level, you know, author from Ireland? Anyway, so I highlight the worst lines and I put them in bold and I sent them around to everybody I knew. I said, are you aware of what your kids are reading? And it was so shocking. And I got like 320 people to go against the school. You know, so I like it. Like when someone's hoodwinking you, it's like, oh no, I don't think so. Do you know what I mean? So you got to go to bat. But, going back to that quiet on the set is when the parents, you know, when in your gut or when the parents or when the crew sense that and they all kind of, oh yeah, we kind of knew somebody should have stood up.
For sure. Yeah, because like in the rearview mirror, now everybody's saying, oh my gosh, yeah, I noticed all these things. Well, you notice them then as well, but it just, but again, it's like, to my mind, that's why it's so important to have somebody who kind of sets that spark and goes, no, this isn't okay. And then people, you know, rally to that.
Right.
I'm curious, you touched on this a moment ago, like in the open, how, you know, things today, like if you're, you know, you said sort of, thank God I'm not starting today because things are much, much worse. There's a lot of people who listen to this show who are makers of some kind, right? Or aspiring makers of some kind. And I know you and I have talked offline about, you know, the idea of, you know, giving mentorship and advice and direction, particularly for makers who have like a faith life, who want to have integrity in what they do and the difficulties that they face, because these are real decisions. And, you know, your faith also evolves over time. Like you might look back at yourself 20 years ago, like I do, and go, oh my gosh, can't believe what a knucklehead or what thing I did. But like, how has the advice changed of like what you would say to somebody when you were getting started versus today? Like a person who's got some type of faith understanding.
I would say, look, it's going to be tough, but stick with your faith because you don't want to be my age and look back and regret. You have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and you have to realize that there's a plan and you don't know why you might not be getting something or why you're challenged, but it all is going to start to make sense later on. You know, and that's hard to say to a young kid. So you have to have the confidence and the faith to know that it's going to work out, but you're going to have to say no sometimes. And as I get older, it's easier because I mean, you know, I'm not so worried about like, what if I would never work or, you know, right. What I mean? You want to build that track record. But I also tell kids, it's a different day and age in a great way in that it's a lot easier to create your own work now. Like I did one woman shows back in the day. And like when I was in my 20s and I would go to auditions, I'd be like, oh, you're going to work when you're in your 40s. You got to kind of be funny. You're kind of funny looking. Your voice is really deep. You know, I was like, I'm not waiting until I'm 40s. I thought that was like, you know, 100. So, but now kids can take a camera and they can, you know, make a short film or make a full length film and establish themselves. Like it's for that, in that way, it's a lot easier. Mm. So, But I've always encouraged, you know, making your own work or writing, because then you're not sitting around waiting for someone else to create for you.
Right. When you look back at your filmography, all the things that you've done, on the whole, perhaps you look at that and say, I'm happy, I'm proud, this, you know, dad would have been okay with all of this. Or is there one or two things that pops out and says, if I had it to do over again, I may have done it differently?
Yes, no, listen, for sure, there was one that I wish I didn't do. I remember my nephew, my sister has a lot of kids, and he got his first BB gum, and his older brother was driving in the cold in Syracuse in a minivan down the hill with the mother and the other kids in the car. And he fired the BB gun at the back windshield, and it exploded. She said it was like we were at war. And, you know, of course, everybody's like, Billy, what'd you do? And he goes, one mistake. So, you know, I have one movie like that I'm like, oh, what, I shouldn't have done that. But for the most part, you know, even now I'll be like, okay, I'm not doing it. So, you know, but it never goes away. Mm. Like, I always tell the story that I did a movie with Lauren Bacall in Denmark, and she was 82 and I was probably like 45, and we were walking up the ramp to the set on the second to last day. And she's like, Siobhan, do you have anything coming up? And I was like, no. And she's like, either do I. Do you think we'll ever work again? I mean, there's always that. You don't know if you're going to work again. And, you know, once in a while, you know, you'll think, is that because I turned that such and such down?
Sure.
Around that maybe I'm like going to say no, or that kind of thing, you know?
And that's kind of like the sort of obstacle of omission that I was kind of referencing earlier. So I've been in rooms, as an example, when I worked at Disney, as an example, and again, I wasn't on the sort of in front of the camera side. I was on the, you know, business side, helping to make things happen side, right?
Of,
you know, organizing deals and, you know, getting advertisers and doing all that kind of stuff. And I remember being in rooms where comments like, oh, but such and such, you know, are they going to be okay with that? They're really religious. Maybe not. We'll look somewhere else. And it was like, it happened in a flash. It was like 3 seconds. And suddenly the potential of this person or organization or direction, like, was just like completely wiped off of possibility. And I imagine myself sitting there as a Christian, although for me, my faith evolved over time. I was very, very heads down about my faith for a long time.
Yeah.
But I would, even then, I would think about that and go like, oh my gosh, like, this thing could have gone completely in a different direction. And somebody just threw up a comment. It wasn't even like an objection. It was just like a statement, like, oh, but they're really religious, aren't they? And then, like, all of a sudden everything changed. Like, you're right, let's look at this other list of things. And to me, I thought, how often does that happen? And the person may not even be aware that happened. They didn't know how close they may have been.
Right.
And I just imagined, I don't know, maybe it happens a lot.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I think once people realize, though, like, that you're reasonable and you're willing to talk about it in a way, maybe work around it, and you're not like, no, you know what I mean? That it can work out. You know what I'm saying? And I will say, like when I was on SNL, like, I used to go to mass with Chris Farley all the time. So it was known that
that's
like,
cool. Where'd you go in New York?
Holy Trinity on 83rd.
Nice.
And yeah, it was awesome. Between Broadway and Amsterdam. And okay, listen, we were no like shrinking violets. We'd have gone to like the cast party till 4 a.m. and then be like, what time are you going to mass? And then it was so fun. But we weren't goody goodies. You know what I mean? Like, we were, you know, living life, but had our set of morals and standards, you know? But luckily too, like, I never had the look to be challenged to do other things that I wouldn't do. You know what I mean? Like, so sometimes things work out or you're protected a little bit.
Mm. Who's the most, like, looking back on your career, and obviously you're still making movies, you're still writing, you're still doing a lot of different things, but kind of looking back, if you were to look back right now, who was like the most, I don't know, religious person that you can imagine or that you worked with? Like, somebody who could, like, just sticks out in your memory as like somebody, and whether it was Christian or not, I'm just curious, like, of all the people that you've known.
You know, oddly, when I was first, I'm just gonna let my dog in. I can hear her jingling at the door.
No problem.
When I first started, I was out in LA and I was like doing plays. I was doing like a play with Dan Castellaneta, Homer Simpson, and it doesn't matter. And so I was been home for Christmas, and I was going back out to LA, and I thought, my gosh, what's going to happen to me? And I was like 29. I was like, well, I'm going to get married. Like, what is going to happen? And I met this guy on a plane, and I had brought muffins. I'd made muffins, and we shared the muffins. And long and short of it, I thought, oh my gosh, this is it. I'm probably going to marry this guy. And I never heard from him. And so then he called me that March, and he said, you're not going to believe it. I had a brain tumor, and I had it removed. And that's why I didn't call you. And I'm like, what the heck? So anyway, he said, but I want to bring you to this play. So I had studied the Sanford Meisner technique, which is a great acting technique. A lot of, you know, Sam Rockwell, and it's a great technique. Mm. So he brings me this play. It's just a small little kind of the equivalent of what New York would be off Broadway. And Patty Heaton was in it. And I was like, wow. It's just before Everybody Loves Raymond. And I was like, she is an amazing actress. And I read, sure enough, she studied the Sanford Meisner technique. So we went out afterwards, we hit it off. And then, of course, she gets Everybody Loves Raymond, and I didn't really see her over the years. Now I wrote my film, Shelter in Solitude. It was my second film, which you saw.
Yeah, it's great.
We did the premiere in Nashville. Patty has since moved to Nashville.
That's right.
She contacts me on social media. She says, Siobhan, could I come to your show? I'm like, your premiere. I would love that. Could I bring 10 people? I would love that. Well, oddly, you can't make it up. I'm from a little town in Casanova, and you know the Hopkins family. Three of the sons were priests. One is a nun. Mimi was her name growing up. She's a nun in the same convent as Patty Heaton's sister in Nashville.
It's crazy. I know. You told me that story before. I still can't believe it. And that one of those boys is my spiritual director, which is even crazier.
And John was not only in my class in Casanova. We were in grammar school, and we moved from Syracuse out to Casanova. So it's crazy. So, but Patty, of course, is very vocal about her faith and not afraid. And then weirdly, I wrote this play, and I said, Patty, this is so crazy because I wrote a play about my family and my sisters in June. I said, and you'd be perfect for my sister, Mary. Whoops. So she comes, oops, we got on.
No, I lost you for a second. You're good.
So long and short of it is, I said, this is so crazy that you want to come and that we reunited. Because I wrote a play and I said, I've thought of you for my sister, Mary. So I would say Patty really sticks out. And I've met a great Jewish friends who, my friend David Goodman, who was the head of the Writers Guild, he was like, invite me to his Seders. Monica and Phil Rosenthal, they'd have me their Seders. So, so I've met really great people over the years that are not afraid to, show who they really are.
Yeah. No, I mean, by the way, the Chris Farley thing you mentioned earlier, I had no idea. I've seen all the, Chris Farley docs and all these different things. And I don't recall ever having heard a story about him, jetting off in the middle to go to mass.
Oh, listen, first of all, when he died, they did a memorial at the Actors Church, St. Malachy's in New York City. And I went, of course, it was packed and thinking there's going to be some big celeb speaking. And a guy who was a shut-in spoke. Because Chris used to bring food and visit the shut-ins.
Wow.
Which was unbelievable. Oh, yes. We would go to church. So the parties would, go like 4 a.m. And he'd be like, oh, my gosh, Siobhan, bless me, Father, I've sinned. Oh, I'm so sorry. he's like, oh, so overly dramatic. Anyway. And then he had, have you ever read the Prayer of the Clown?
No.
Oh, it's a beautiful prayer. Huh. He gave it to me. He wrote it out. When he died, I walked it down because Lorne Michaels lived on the Upper West Side at the time, and I brought it down to him, and it's a beautiful prayer.
Oh, I got to look that up.
Chris kept that with him at all times.
I'm going to put that in the show notes so people can read it. Yeah, I never met him, but obviously a fan of his work on SNL and other places. I thought he was hysterical.
Hilarious.
And he always struck me, and I think a lot of comics have this, as people with a lot of heart, but also some woundedness, right? Where,
oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? But like, I always, I can totally see what you're describing, even though I've never heard it otherwise, but because he always struck me as a person with just a lot of like love to give, and for a variety of different reasons, impeded in that desire.
Yeah. I mean, and he was from a big Irish family and all the greatness that comes with it, but then the self-deprecating humor and, so much of Tommy Boy is, exactly like what he was like and like his family and stuff. but no, just a great guy, really great guy.
Siobhan, how did your faith, like, you know, kind of walk us through, you know, throughout your career? Because I can imagine that, you know, all of us are kind of evolving in our understanding in, and it's kind of peaks and valleys, right? Sometimes we feel maybe really close to God. We're like really kind of hitting it. You know, we're praying, we're maybe having a great sacramental life. And then other moments we kind of go into that valley, a little desolation and what have you. But if you kind of zoom out, like, and maybe from the moment that you decided to get into the entertainment industry, which I'd love to understand, just like, when did you know you wanted to be actress and go into that? But like, how did God show up in that journey? Like, how was it sort of, how did it evolve?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would say at the beginning, it's all faith because, you know, everybody will tell you, you know, it's too hard to do this. People train from the time they were, you know, 4 years old to be singers and dancers. And people telling you, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. I went to college, to Le Moyne College. I was studying to be a teacher. I knew I wanted to be an actress, but I was like, I can't, and I would do all the plays. So how do you tell that? Like that people just don't do that, you know, from upstate New York. So my senior year, I was like, I don't want a student teacher. Nothing. I admire teachers so much, but I was like, I really want to be an actress. So I go down to New York. And my aunt was a journalist and she was best friends with Jackie Gleason's daughter, Linda Miller. Mm. Anyway, so I would pray. I'd be like, please God, if this is the way, lead me. Well, she said to me, you should go to Catholic University. They have a great graduate school program. And that's where, you know, John Voight, Susan Sarandon, all these, it was an amazing program at the time. So, I mean, I literally auditioned for two schools. I mean, that was, so I went down and, you know, I just always knew that prayer was the way. And when there's so much rejection, you know,
It's brutal.
Even in graduate school, it's like, what the heck? So, and a lot of times, like I'll tell my daughter is an actress now. And I'll say, you know, there's so many crazy layers to this business because you don't know if someone, you know, in an acting class or something doesn't like you because they really want to be an actor and they have hangups or, so you got to get rid of all the noise and just be like, oh, that was the other thing. I never idolized people. I never was starstruck or nervous about that because I knew that there's something so much more important.
I want to pause on that because that is a gift, okay? And in a very small way, I've shared it. Maybe my personality is one that I'm pretty even keel. Like not a lot of things throw me. So I always assumed that maybe that was what it was, that I wasn't just exuberant with glee the moment that somebody who may be famous was next to me. Everybody wanted to get autographs. I used to fly the LA to New York, you know, shuttle basically for years when I worked at Disney and Univision. And inevitably every flight, there'd be a couple, 2-3 famous people on the plane. And I'd come home and I'd say, oh, I sat down, you know, Anthony Hopkins was on my flight or Denzel Washington was on my flight. And my daughter at the time would say, did you get an autograph? Did you take a picture? And I was like, no, that's just not my thing. And she would always get upset with me. But it, looking back on that and now hearing you say it, it is such a gift to not be sort of starstruck in that way, because when we are, you know, you can be led into these positions and situations where you feel kind of powerless to do something, especially if something comes up that isn't right, isn't kosher.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I remember when I was in LA, I was like 29 and I was teaching English as a second language. And my students were Hispanic at one school, like the ages of like 18 to 25. And because it was during Reagan's era when he was giving money if you went to school. And then I had Japanese students. Well, anyway, one time in my the Hispanic class, I said, gloating, when I look back on it, gross, why would I do that? I was like, guys, I'm not going to be here tomorrow because I'm down to the end for the new Carol Burnett show. Mm. And I had the student Stella, who was from Venezuela, raise her hand and said, who is Carol Burnett?
Who's that? Yeah.
And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm such an idiot. And, you know, in the United States, she was really important. Of course, this is before the internet, before all, you know, this, we were more, you know, insulated. And I thought, I'm such a jerk. Why would I brag about that? And at the end of the, when we're all pushing up the daisies, no one cares what movie you're in, what awards you got. It doesn't matter, you know? So I think for that reason, my faith really helped me. And then, okay, so then it goes on. And I will say, during the time when the kids were little, and till they till Sinead, my youngest, was a junior, it wasn't that hard to stay even keeled because, and I told this to my daughter too, one of the hardest parts about being an actress is the rejection and is the down period and continuing to have hope. So you have to have that gift of turning over to God, knowing everything's going to be okay, knowing you will have a job, but maintaining your sanity in between, as well as your spirit and be, don't just be thinking about being an actress, you know, volunteer or do other things to make your life, you know, well-rounded, not so egotistical, not thinking about yourself all the time. So, but it got hard when my last daughter was going off to college because I thought, what will I do with myself? So that's when I wrote my first movie, Rushed, because I thought, okay, I work about 4 to 6 months out of the year. What am I going to do for the rest of the 6 months? And I don't want to be down in the dumps. So that's when I said, I'm going to try to go to daily mass as much as I can. Because what else am I doing? The big, you know, like what excuse? Oh, I'm busy. I got to clean or I got to do this. You know, just ridiculous. Like my father always went to daily mass. And I'm like, okay, listen, you got to help me. I don't even know how to write a script. I don't know. I mean, I've been in enough of them, but help me out. And that's when I really started to, I feel like my faith really got deeper and, you know, you really got, you know, you were able to have more time. The kids are older. And then now the movie comes out and you're like, uh-oh, we got through that. Now what if nobody goes to see it? What I got to pay these investors back. You know, so the whole time you're depending on God. And then when you really get down and say the chips are against you, like, uh-oh, it didn't sell to so-and-so, but so-and-so is going to take it. Then you really can start to question yourself like, hey, I'm peddling my goods out here. I gave it 500%. Now what if it doesn't work out? Well, my father used to say, well, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? You're not dead. And you have to go on. And, you know, and I tell this too, like your lows are what make you more creative and I don't know. I feel like they're a gift. You know what I mean? It's hard to realize at the time.
It's hard to look at any arts field, whether it's writing or sculpture or painting or theater, and not find examples just all over the place of people who did their very best work at some of the lowest moments.
Oh, yeah. You know, it was so crazy. So with the movie Rushed, you know, it came out in 2021, my first film, and I had all intentions of taking a break. So I was like, I'm exhausted. We filmed the movie. We edit it. I need a break. And so then I got this idea for Shelter and Solitude in the middle of the night. I feel it was the Holy Spirit. It was my father. They sent me this idea of this man on death row, this crazy, you know, me, country singer, Robert Patrick as the warden. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go for it. So right on top of the other, Rush gets released August 28th, 2021. 3 weeks later, we start filming. People are like, you crazy? This is too much. Okay. Now it's really 4 years later when we finish editing, we're getting the other movie out. And I start to go into a low. And I've never really gone for long periods of time into a low and have anxiety and everything. My sister Megan is awesome. She's single. We call her the runaway bride. She's a little bit of the runaway bride. Not a little bit, she is. And
it's funny because I feel like I've met her just by going to the reading of your play.
Yeah, right? So she, every November, she has 125 singers and a 25-piece orchestra, and she puts on, like, this year will be Schubert's Mass, I believe. Mozart's Mass. Okay, so she said, so she did Charles Grenot, who, you know, I'm kind of like the village idiot, but she's so schooled in all this. So I said to her, my gosh, this anxiety, what is it? I can't stand it. And she said, well, you know, Charles Grenot back in the 1800s, you know, wrote an opera and then he wrote a mass. And then he did something else. And she said, because she said, Siobhan, I think you're like a computer that's overloaded and it's burned out and needs to be turned down. And, you know.
Yeah, you need to restart. Hard reset.
Yeah, hard reset. So she said, I go, oh, really? So what happened to him? She said, oh, well, he went into an insane asylum for a year. I go, did he come out? She's like, I was like, okay. But honestly, I was so glad that happened to me because, you know, you can get going at such a speed that you're like, you're forgetting what life is all about. Like, I'd be like, well, honestly, in my head, I'd be like, what's with people relaxing and hanging out and sitting on the porch or just, you know, like, the, you know, going to Florida for a couple weeks. Like, what's that about?
Yeah.
Like, why don't you get going, lazy? Like, being a little judgmental. Like, come on, oobah badoo, keep moving. So I feel like those lows help you, as you say, reset, get closer to God, and then creativity comes out of it too. You come up with an idea, you know what I mean?
And it makes logical sense. I mean, the Jesuits, you know, talk about desolation and consolation, right? The sort of
yes.
like the ebb and flow of our relationship with God. And you ask yourself in the moments of desolation, like, where'd you go, God? Where'd you go, right? And we don't often think about that distance or feeling of desolation as being in a way medicinal, right? It's medicinal for us. And in the same way that, like, you know, you think of it as a parent, you know, if your kid is glommed onto you all day and he can't put his shoes on without you tying them for him or whatever. At
yes.
some point, you kind of stiff arm a little bit, and it hurts to do it as you're doing it. But then
yes.
the child recognizes, oh yeah, you know what? And the relationship actually matures and grows, right? So in
that's
a way,
great,
that's like
that's
what God's doing.
Yes, that's so great. Yeah, that's amazing. Actually, I was never an exerciser, and. By the way, my sisters that you saw the place of three sisters, they're all really athletic. Like, they all play golf. I used to ride bikes with my sister, Mary, and no lie, she'd be so far ahead of me. And there was a hill in my town in Casanova called Wright Road. And it was literally like, you know, so steep. You couldn't believe it. She'd be ahead of me and she'd be up the hill. And I'd be like one
dying.
Pedal,
yeah.
two pedal off the bike, walk it up. I'd be like, I always told my family, I'm like, I was born with NMT, no muscle tone. So I decided about, 2 years ago to start doing Pilates. Cause I
oh,
try to
wow.
be like, you know, try to be like the others. And like, so I thought, oh my gosh, recently, like 2 months ago, I was like, I am really athletic and I didn't know it.
Mm.
And I am going to be, I'm so well cut to that. As soon as I swear, I thought that I felt something in my back go. And I was like, oh, and I herniated two discs in my back. Now at this point, my play, we were supposed to do it in October. And literally I'm like in a wheelchair. I can't move. So I had to be in my bed for like 2 weeks and I kind of liked it. I was like, it's great.
Yeah.
Getting to read as much as I can, getting to relax. I'm like, I have so many documentaries on Netflix or other, you know, shows. And I was like, okay, so this is in God's hands. So we'll do the play next spring and it will be even better. And then we'll be really prepared. Which, by the way, have you met, do you know the documentary Unguarded?
No,
you
possibly.
You should have this woman, Similetta. I just met her.
Sure.
I went down to Catholic University about 2 weeks ago to show my film Shelter in Solitude. And a woman came, Chris Ann, I forget her last name. She's awesome. And she's the head of the Catholics Against Capital Punishment.
Mm.
So she's like, Siobhan, would you take your movie to other campuses and talk to I said, I would love to. So she said, you have to meet this woman, Similetta. She's from Italy. She directed this film and created called Unguarded about these Brazilian prisoners where they believe that love and
rehabilitation. Wait a minute. You know, I think a friend of mine, TJ Burden, may be involved with that movie.
Well, I think because you may be right. That name, I just watched it literally yesterday.
Yeah, because I remember talking to him a while ago and him saying something along the same kind of idea, right? Brazilian prison, they have like a completely
it's
different
beautiful.
Approach to things.
Oh,
it
it's
might be
amazing.
The same thing.
It's amazing. And that's where, you know, also going back to that question about being in this business and what advice do you give? It's like we can really use this business as a tool to spread the word without a doubt, which is what I'm trying to do with my films.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the biggest opportunity. And you and I have riffed on this a little bit, but I mean, I've had my, you know, my nits to pick with, you know, faithful or Christian, specifically Catholic makers, because a lot of the things that, you know, that I've seen from a media standpoint qualitatively just don't measure up, right? And it's like you've got this sort of amazing story and, you know, amazing opportunity to tell, you know, sort of the greatest stuff in the universe, really, but we haven't been able to sort of execute that as well as we should. And I think part of that has been that the people who are the most talented, the best writers, the best, you know, DPs, the best actors, that kind of thing, for the most part are doing the other stuff, right? But so
right.
when I see people like you, like Patricia Heaton, others, you know, start to do things, you know, that are you know, lived basically informed by your Christian understanding of the world, and you're doing it at a much different level of quality. I'm like, okay, that now we just need to do like 10,000 more of those. You know what I mean? But yeah. It's like, that's the promise, is using media and right. story, because that's what Jesus did. He used story. Right.
And that's what John Paul II thought, that the art will change the culture, because the culture is so off track. But that's why we then, Charlie, you and I have talked about this, is that we have to get the money people to be on board, to be like, look, do you want this to be done? So
why aren't they on board?
I don't know. I mean, like, I remember after 9/11, and my husband worked, you know, in the World Trade Center, and Congressman Peter King met with Joe Sella from Legatus. There was a whole bunch of us that met. And he said, why are the Catholics so shy or not loud about our faith? And what is it? I don't know. But I feel like if some, you know, obviously, you know, Mark Wahlberg is doing it, but you've got to get money behind it. Because like, okay, so like films like mine. So my films are independent films. They're great. They get good reviews. I'm not saying I'm great. I'm saying, so they do well. They get, you know, good reviews. People love the movies. But then who's really winning Academy Awards? It's the ones with all the
of course.
Giant budgets. To get the really big, you got to have some big money behind you to get the really big notice. You know, so everybody's got to come together. You know what I mean?
I think there's only two theories. I was just talking about this actually with Tim Rekard on the show. Tim Rekard is a Academy Award winning animator, and he directed the Sony picture, The Star. It was an animated kind of, Christmas movie a few years ago, but he didn't win an Academy Award for that. He won an Academy Award for one of his shorts. But I was talking to him about this, and I have two theories, and I don't know if I'm right, but because when I think of money people, getting the big money people that are kind of like Christian or Catholic aligned, I kind of put them in two camps. They're sort of like, or two objections, two types of objections, two reasons why we're not able to get their support. One side of it is a general kind of aversion or distance or lack of understanding of things that are creative, like a suspicion of things that are creative. If they're creative, then they can't really be about like the faith, and you know, it's like you know, there's some hesitation there that I can't really put my finger on. But when you talk to like people who are very wealthy, who support other initiatives, who found schools, you know, who like, you know, put their name on the side of a building, like people like that, and creative stuff generally, like, I don't know, there's like a distance between them and a creative project. The other reason is, or the other objection, is the like really metrics or, you know, key performance indicator inspired type of investor, where they're like, okay, if I give you $10 million, I want to know I'm getting $30 million back. And if not, why would I take that risk? And so I think the combination of both of those things keeps us a little bit in kind of a, broadly speaking, not your work, but just in general, keeps us in a bit of a creative ghetto, because it's like we can't get the type of risk-taking that the rest of the secular world does all the time because of those two kind of reasons. So I like when I see Angel Studios as an example, kind of changing the model a little bit and going, look, we're going to create like a pilot, and if you like it, then we'll fund it, and then we can crowdfund and all this other stuff. So in a way, it's led to some of these other models and methods. But I think like those two reasons, at least in my experience, explain some of why this isn't happening. Because some of these guys have no problem, you know, saying, oh, you need $30 million for a new wing on the library at CUA. Yeah. Sure. But like, what could you do with $30 million in the area of content? And not just a film, but like other types of content, podcasts, variety of different things. So I don't know, but that's as close as I've ever come to sort of thinking it through.
Yeah. I think that like, and obviously like there's the faith-based movies that we think of as like with the perfect people and the perfect story, and that it has the Christian audience, but it's not getting the whole audience, because sometimes we can't really relate to people that are perfect a lot of times. So then like films like my films, it's like, then you're right. Then you have people saying, well, it's not a movie about a saint. It's not straight down the line Catholic. It's more the Mary Magdalene type of people. It's like damaged people that are trying to do their best. It's more human. So then they get nervous, like, well, maybe it's not holy enough or something.
That's what I mean. Know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I'm going this Sunday. I'm going to be going to the screening of Ethan Hawke's new movie, Wildcat.
I'm going tonight. I'm going tonight.
Are you really? Okay, yeah. Yeah. It's this, I think on Saturday I'm going in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And I'm super stoked to see that because the trailer looks amazing. Flannery O'Connor's story is so cool and all that stuff. I'm excited about that, but my sense is that I don't know what it took to get that movie done. I know some of the people that are involved in making it, but like, I think you're hitting on some of the reasons that, you know, there's not more of those things made, but maybe as we start seeing more of them, that can inspire people. Have you been like, what's something you've seen maybe over the last several years that you think is an example of the kind of sort of the new Christian movie making besides your films? I would put your films in that category, by the way. I would put your film, Shelter and Solitude specifically, in that category. They are Christian films. They're just not self-referentially so. They're not this is a Christian movie.
Okay, of course, obviously Fatima is like in a category of its own, and that's purely Catholic and it's absolutely spectacular.
Yep.
Then you have something like St. Vincent, which is Bill Murray, Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful movie and it's a fabulous message. And then you might even have something like Peanut Butter Falcon.
Yeah, I remember that one with Shia. You
know, Shia LaBeouf. And it's like, that is, you know, a beautiful movie with a beautiful message underneath. So
I saw that. It was great. I'm trying to get him on the show because he's discerning the diaconate. I'm like,
oh yeah, I know. It's amazing. And you know, I played his mother in Holes.
I know. That's why I mentioned it. Yeah.
Love him. So yeah, I know. And he's like, it's amazing what he's done. You know, there's life at such a young age, you know, to be, you know, really examining himself and learning about, the Catholic faith. It's pretty incredible. So anyway, I mean, hopefully we're making inroads and that things will change.
Yeah.
I think things will change. It's just like, we've got to, you know, if we need someone to get behind us, who's got the big money.
I think
Angel Studios did.
I just think seeing the success of other things, right? The Chosen, you know, Sound of Freedom, things like that, monetary success, economic success. Seeing that, I think, gets people to kind of turn the corner a little bit and go, okay, maybe there's something here. And even if I don't agree with it, I'll kind of get behind doing it. So at the end of the day, I think it just means more at-bats with better quality stuff, getting it out there, and then having enough of a groundswell sort of take over. But we definitely have a story to tell.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. I know I've got to get you going. I wish I had 3 more hours with you.
Oh my gosh, Charlie, it was great talking to you.
But tell us just like how people can keep up with what you're up to. You know, you've talked about your projects that are out right now, but just a general way to kind of follow along with you as you kind of progress into this next area.
So people can follow me at Siobhan Fallon Hogan on Instagram, and then at Siobhan Fallon Hogan. I'm so bad with whatever that is, social media. And then Shelter and Solitude, people can watch on Amazon or Apple and all those kind of things. Rushed as well. And then my play, A Mother's Last Day, if all is going according to plan, will be out in off-Broadway next year. So, And I mean, and then hopefully there'll be more projects to come.
And I can give a little plug for the play, which I cannot wait to actually see perform live. I got a chance to go to the reading of that play and I was just blown away. You know that, and because I told you right afterwards, but it was really a gift to be there. I thought it was so well written and so well acted, even in just obviously it's just a reading room, but just it was so well done that I could imagine the visualization and the actual performance of it. And I kind of put the writing in a category with David Mamet, interestingly, because it was done at the Atlantic, which I didn't even know he founded. But it was so, so good. And, you know, Siobhan, count on our prayers for the continued prosperity of your work. And you're welcome anytime. We'll obviously be following all of your stuff with great interest. And just really appreciate it. A real privilege to have you come on the show.
Thanks so much, Deacon Charlie. I so appreciate it. You have no idea. And I'll be praying for you, too, and I thank you for your continued support.
Awesome. If you're listening to Our Voices, that means it's time to follow this show. Share this episode with that aspiring actor, actress, director, producer. Just send it to them. Let them see somebody who's really lived an integrated Christian life throughout the ups and downs of the entertainment industry. It can be done, and we need more of you to do it. We'll see you again next time on Living the Call.
This podcast is part of the Spoke Street Network. For more great podcasts, visit SpokeStreet.com.